This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. This is your host, Jerry Zahavi, and today we have the second of two documentaries from Hindsight, the radio program produced by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, focusing on the social history of Australia. Today's program is titled The Thallium Enthusiasms and focuses on a 1953 epidemic of poisonings that swept through Sydney, Australia.
Pretend you're happy when you're blue. It isn't very hard to do. And you'll find happiness without an end whenever you pretend.
Thallium is a poison which insinuates itself through the body into every muscle, the bodily tissues, and especially the nervous system. One of the first symptoms is a hypersensitivity, which results in pins and needles in the feet and legs, and which becomes
a soft, malleable, rare metal element. Its salt produces a highly toxic substance. Extended ingestion of thallium causes nausea, delirium, blindness, and ultimately, death.
I don't know what subconscious urge made me buy thallium. I was in Knock and Kirby's looking at plants when I found myself
Caroline
face
Grills,
to face with a
bottle. Mrs. Veronica Monty, Mrs. Yvonne Fletcher, Mrs. Beryl Haig, Mrs. Ruby Norton.
Give him a headache.
Death-dealing thallium, an odorless, tasteless, colorless liquid, can still be purchased over the counter at any grocery store in a commercial preparation known as foul rat. The frightful consequences of this drug were unheard of.
It's the fun of the world.
Pick up any daily newspaper in Sydney during 1953 and you'd be bound to read about an unusual crime wave which swept the city throughout that year. It took the form of a rash of sometimes petty and sometimes serious acts involving poison. And that year, one particular poison was in fashion. It was thallium, the base for many well-known brands of rat poison at the time, products like Thalrash, Endorash, and DDD Death. In fact, the popularity of these products in dealing with Sydney's pervasive rat problem made them available over the counter at any local milk bar or corner store. As well as its easy availability, thallium also held other attractions to the potential poisoner. It was odourless, colourless and tasteless. And most importantly, it was fatal to humans in large doses. In the vogue for poison-based crimes which hit Sydney during 1953, thallium became notorious, with numerous accounts of its use during lovers' tiffs, in domestic bust-ups or attempts at suicide. And because one of the signs of thallium poisoning was a fairly rapid loss of hair, it even became the basis of a series of bizarre practical jokes that fascinated Sydney at the time. But amidst the thallium-induced petty crime and practical jokes which engulfed Sydney in 1953, there were also some serious attempts at murder, crimes which saw five women stand trial. All were charged with the homicidal use of thallium. Mrs. Yvonne Gladys Fletcher was the first of these women to go to the dock, and following close behind her was the notorious case of 63-year-old alleged poisoner Mrs. Carolyn Grills, later dubbed Aunt Thally by the press hounds who followed her every move. She was charged with fatally poisoning four relatives and had a go at poisoning seven other of her relations, though some family members claim her innocence to this day. Mrs. Grills was also the only woman to go to jail. The three others charged with thallium poisoning in 1953 were Mrs. Beryl Haig, Mrs. Ruby Norton, and Mrs. Veronica Monty, who reached front page status after poisoning her son-in-law lover with thallium.
This was an experiment, a social and cultural experiment, that people carried out alongside the wider cultural, social, national experiments that typified the post-war and Cold War era.
Noel Sanders teaches cultural studies at the University of Technology in Sydney, and he's written about the 1953 poisonings in the context of the Cold War period in Australia. But how can we, first of all, explain this prevalent use of rat poison as a trigger for so much crime in Sydney? Well, according to Noel Sanders, getting your hands on some thallium in 1953 was as easy as buying milk.
It was, as I understand it from the subsequent newspaper reports, ubiquitous. In most corner shops, when Veronica Monty appeared in court to say how she'd discovered the dreadful stuff, she said she'd been in Knock and Kirby's buying pot plants, and she'd seen some on the counter and been inspired to investigate the possibilities of it. But of course, people first came to know of it then as a pesticide and as a rodenticide rather than as a homicidal instrument. And I guess it was only really after the first of the people who was arrested for using it, namely Yvonne Fletcher, it was really upon the outcome of those reports that people started to know of its further uses, as it were. And certainly in the case of Ruby Norton, who was from a station up near Bathurst, who polished off her son-in-law, she would have heard it from the newspapers, and they were quite graphic. They told you about not just simply how to kill somebody, but how to produce symptoms on their bodies, how to produce various kinds of debilitation. Yvonne Fletcher, for example, may not and probably didn't wish to actually polish off the first of her husbands, but rather get him out of the house. She really wanted him to go somewhere else. And when he came back, I think she upped the dose and knew exactly what to do, how much dosage to use. So this was much bruited in the papers, but some older people that I've talked to, people now in their 70s and 80s, who can remember the whole thing as a long-running kind of popular enthusiasm, will say, for example, that between the late 30s, when Thelrat, the active and commercial form of it, came on the market, and the first arrests, they say nobody really knows how many people might have died of this.
Mrs. Yvonne Gladys Fletcher, convicted of murdering her first husband in 1948 and second husband in 1952 with the poison thallium. The death penalty was later commuted to life imprisonment.
After Desi died, I married Bluey Fletcher in 1952. It was about 4 months after we're married, Bluey started getting sick. And I get to thinking, you're no good to me, Bluey. If your feet are all numb, what's the good of that? Pins and needles. Just an excuse, if you ask me. You want to sneak off with the boys, don't you? Well, go on. I'm not keeping you, am I? When did I ever stop you? Of course, I'm not good enough for you, am I? A few hours with me dancing? Oh, you're not up to that, are you? Well, I'll tell you one thing, Bluey Fletcher. You're not the only fish in the ocean, not by a long shot.
That's the character Vonnie from the John Romrell play Mrs. Thalieff. Loosely based on the Yvonne Fletcher case, Romrell didn't discover the story until 1971. And though it was nearly 20 years after the events, they'd lost none of their original tabloid appeal.
Well, I first struck it in a cheap bit of pulp faction, a sort of barbershop, railway station kind of book called Wicked Women of Australia. And it was essentially a 19th and 20th century span of colourful women wrongdoers over a couple of centuries. And she was one of them.
How did it paint her, John? What was the portrait of her?
As a woman who really was sort of like inside a party girl, trapped in a couple of bum marriages, and the quickest way out was the rat poison.
Here, here's some tea. I don't know why I bother. Well, drink it down. Next to useless you are. What am I to do, spend the day bringing you tea? No thanks. Oh, look at you, the spew on your chin, Bluey. And there you go, bringing up your tea. I ought to scrape it off your shirt back into the cup and give it to you all over again. Worse than a bloody baby. I hope you've got control of your bowels. That's enough for a divorce these days, not having control. Oh, Jesus, give me strength. How come you're doing all the crying? Now I'm supposed to wipe away your tears for you. I've had it. I tell you, I'm sick of you swinging them punches whenever I say boo. You're always slamming into me. It's not good enough, I tell you. All the other women have got nice new dresses. I haven't had a new dress since 1948. 4 years. Fancy keeping a girl like me in rags. You even go crook when I do my makeup to cover the bruises. You're lowering me. Bluey Fletcher, you're dragging me down to your level. It's not good enough. I've tried so hard. My aunt took me to dancing lessons. I had shoes with steel caps in them. I did real dancing. Real.
She seemed to me a bit of a case of, you know, someone who really couldn't handle the real and sought refuge in, you know, an unreal world or a fantasy world. Her kind of fixation with dance and you know, modern swing music, that kind of hedonistic fantasy kind of dance hall self was when she felt most alive, and the rest had become fairly humdrum for her, and that was a pretty interesting angst, I reckon. And that kind of psychopathic state, I suppose, is very interesting. You know, heroes are what? You know, people find themselves in grim situations and do something about it. And she was one of those. Whether or not we agree with what she did.
The crime of murder is a terrible one. And when the killing is by means of an insidious poison, secretly administered within the family circle to an unsuspecting victim, which destroyed him both mentally and physically, while permitting him to linger on for months in wretched agony, then the crime is a horrible one.
When the judge announced the verdict, the death sentence, I closed my eyes and fainted. I dropped the gilt-edged prayer book I was carrying and fainted.
Mrs. Caroline Grills, Mrs. Veronica Monty, Mrs. Yvonne Fletcher, Mrs. Beryl Haig, Mrs. Ruby Norton.
Main kind of enthusiasm had to do with city people in suburbs that rats mostly infested, running from basically from Drummoyne right through to Paddington at the time, and that experienced bad rodent problems during the war, as well as for a century, 2 centuries before that. Basically, it was an urban population who was interested in it.
Because the thallium poisonings of the 50s are particularly suburban in their context.
They were, and it's connected to a post-war series of circumstances which people had to endure. Having a look at all these cases, and there must be 70, 80 or 90 of them all up Some of them recorded, some of them not recorded. Some of them serious, some of them not serious. Some without much detail or background at all. I mean, in the Sydney Morning Herald in the middle of June of 1953, there could be 3-4 a day. And it was quite clear that the police had, as the journalists didn't either, had no capacity to follow any of them up or much interest either. But in all of those cases, you can see some effects of the urban post-war situation. For example, every night there would be blackouts in Sydney, and blackout zones would be advertised on the front page of the Herald. This is in the early 50s. Mm. As well, there was radical coal shortages that meant that people went without warm living circumstances in winter and thus were wide open to the yearly plagues that seemed to sweep through. There were some vaccines were available at those times, but in one year it'd be cholera and the next year it'd be typhoid. Sometimes it'd be a bad flu, sometimes it'd be diphtheria. As well as that, there were extreme circumstances with regard to food and nutrition. In early 1952, there was a potato plague in Victoria, and people were living on ersatz foods until well into the 50s. Mm. So there were a number of straitened type of circumstances there which met with bad hygiene and bad sewerage and a proliferating rat population that put people in this kind of frame of mind whereby they had to kind of make their living environment livable and pestilence free. And I think they kind of jumped the borders. They jumped categories in a way and started using this thing not only within the domestic situation that Thelrat was good for around the home, but just generally speaking, moving it around in other sorts of ways, in other sorts of places as well.
Come in. Well, if I knew you were coming, I'd have baked the cake, bake the cake, bake the cake. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked the cake. Hatcha-do, hatcha-do, hatcha-do.
This is Carolyn Grills, sentenced to life imprisonment in 1953 for fatally poisoning four of her relatives.
Drop me a letter, I'd have hired a band and spread the welcome back for you. Oh, I don't know where you came from.
Rats have been the bane of my life for years. They were bad at the old place in Redfern, great big ones there. And I thought I'd be rid of them once I'd got out of town. But wouldn't you know it? After I moved right out here to Gladesville, rat droppings start appearing in the kitchen. Anyway, I rang the council, and the fellow there suggested I go and buy the biggest bottle of Thalrat in the shop. And it's a very good thing to have in the home, I can tell you. You know, my neighbours keep fowls. Can't stand the things myself. But of course, wherever you get fowls, you get rats. And the other day, I offered my cards partners, Mrs. Lundberg and Mrs. Downey, I offered them some thallium, because, you know, I'm sure I've heard rat scratchings during cards at their houses. It seemed a nice way of suggesting the problem of rats to them. I always keep a 1-ounce bottle of thallium in my cupboard. Let's see. It's that cupboard above the stove. There, see, there's my Thalrat. Right next to that box of chockies I'm going to give to dear old Mrs. Mickelson when I next see her. Mrs. Grills, she'll say, you're too kind.
With the case of Mrs. Grills, one of the best known, best documented poisonings of the 50s, during the enthusiasms, during the wave, what was her reason?
Oh, who can say? It's possible that she simply extended, if she was guilty, her normal modes of getting about. She was like a lot of women in that resource and food straitened era, in the sense that she would cook for people. From my childhood memories, people indeed would never come on a visit without a bag of veggies from the garden and a bunch of flowers, some cookery and some lollies to pacify the kids. And it was that circulation of foodstuffs and other sorts of comforts and solaces during the 50s that was part and parcel of the ordinary day-to-day conviviality of society. And Mrs. Grills was such a person. She was, everybody said, a great bountiful kind of a person. At 63, she'd seen a family to adulthood and was able to live a life whereby she cooked for people. She was interested in things. She was a spiritualist, or she was interested in spiritualism like a lot of women of her era. So she was, in a way, a woman of her times, and she was as well an inner city dweller, and was party to all sorts of information about what was going on in her community, in her society, as well as in her family.
Detective Ferguson thinks that I helped Mrs. Mickelson out of this world with my foul rat. And I said to him, why would I have to do a thing like that? I have no reason. I have nothing to gain. And he said, well, they found traces of thallium in the pocket of your brown frock, Mrs. Grills. How do you explain that? Well, I always keep a bottle of thallium in the house. It's the best thing for the rats. But if I wanted to do anything else with it, well, I'd have to keep it in my pocket all the time, wouldn't I? And you'd have to be very smart, because there are always a lot of people about. Yes, you'd have to be very clever.
The Truth, June 16th, 1953. All this week, a fierce spotlight's played upon the tiny figure of Mrs. Carolyn Grills as her trial continues in the Sydney City Coroner's Court. Mrs. Grills, approximately 4 feet 3 inches, is well preserved for her 63 years. Her hair is almost free of grey, and her brown eyes light up as she smiles and laughs her way through the court case. In her hands, she clutches a gay floral scarf, which she uses to foil press photographers. Mrs. Grills appeared to enjoy her skirmishes and forays with the eager cameraman, and once, when she reached the courtroom, leaving a trail of rueful photographers in her wake, she gasped,
it's the fun of the world.
Some of the pressmen and hacks who covered the thallium poisonings in the 50s still drink at Sydney's Journalists Club. Photographers Orb McCarthy and Arthur Bullard both snapped front page shots of Mrs. Grills during her trial.
First time I saw her, she was in the company of a detective. There was, at that stage, Detective Sergeant Don Ferguson, and he was leading her through this courtyard at Central prior to going into the court.
Yeah. And did you talk about a nickname for her?
Aunt Thally.
Aunt Thally.
Yeah. Thallium.
Thallium, you see. She poisoned her relatives with thallium, that's how they call her Aunt
Thally. Aunt Thally. Yeah, we had to chase her around a bit. We got her eventually. You know, she had this hat that came right down around, you remember?
And a big veil on it.
And a big veil on it.
And why didn't she wear that?
Well, she didn't want to be identified.
Well, Ferguson told me that his exact words were, she's a bloody old villain and we've got her to rights, or words to that effect.
Yeah. What did she seem like? Did she seem nervous? Can you remember?
Oh, no, she was a nice old lady. She looked like a
dumpy.
Swattish and average weight and everything like that. And, you know, thallium was only rat poison. And she found out that it would be the same on humans. And used a certain amount of scandal.
She sold a lot of papers.
Basil Sweeney. I was the deputy police roundsman at the Daily Mirror in the 40s and early 50s. I can't recollect exactly how I came to know about it, but it would have been from someone at the CIB, probably from Ferguson, who was the detective sergeant then, and his partner Fred Cray. They were known as the poisons experts at the CIB, simply because they had been given a poison investigation, and so they, partly because of the pressures to personalise these people and make them experts in something. Hmm. Not that they were, but they were pretty smart detectives nevertheless. And they probably would have dropped a hint to us at some stage when we were having a drink with them, and it followed on from there. Hmm. It soon dawned on us that it was a much better story than it might have been otherwise, especially with the fact that there seemed to be so many of them unfold one after another. And of course Mrs. Grills was she was something different. Mm. She was like the little old lady, but there was really something bizarre about it. And that's what kicked the story on. It became a day-to-day event, you know. I think it was the fact that she was everybody's mother or aunt, and And people found it incomprehensible that that someone like Mark Thalley, as they called it, could actually do this sort of thing. In fact, I remember having some doubts as to whether the whole story was ever told, but because there was no precedent to this, as far as I'm concerned, it's sort of a mass murder. Mm. Typically, of course, what they always said was the woman's way of doing things. Get rid of the male, but nevertheless, I think a lot of people just couldn't come to accept the fact that she was doing this, even the detectives. Yeah.
And she had supporters, I think, didn't she?
A lot of people, I wouldn't say they actually fell in love with her, but they were charmed by the odd statements that she would be given to make, you know, sort of throwaway lines and things like that. Plus, she, if ever anyone supposedly looked like a murderer, she didn't. Mm. She just like a little old lady.
You always hurt the one you love, the one you shouldn't hurt at all.
Detective Ferguson asked me if old Mrs. Mickelson had ever complained to me of pains and tingles and the like in her legs. Well, I told him, she used to get pains in her legs all the time. Her legs were all gone, the poor dear. I'd have to get the tea when I was over there, because Mrs. Mickelson had got that way that she couldn't use her legs at all. But they all go that way, don't they?
Word you can't recall. So
it was starting to gel then, this thallium affair. In the early days, there were quite a few poisonings around Sydney. Some were accidental, some were suspicious, and some were outright attempts to kill people.
Dave Dixon was another reporter at Sydney's Daily Mirror during the thallium enthusiasms.
There was a case of Mrs. Grills, Aunt Sally as she was known. She was quite a fascinating character, and she lived not very far from the Mirror in Great Buckingham Street. Anyway, I went along there and I tried to interview, I think, Mrs. Grills, but the place was shut up as tight as a pawnbroker's safe, and she wasn't there. But Detective Sergeant Don Ferguson, Detective Sergeant Fred Cray, after the suspicion focused on Mrs. Grills, decided to call on her and have a little chat. So they knocked on the door, and Mrs. Grills received him rather graciously and ushered them in. She's an old fusspot, you know, really old fusspot down there. And they seated themselves down there in the little parlour. And Mrs. Grill said, "Would you like a cup of tea?"
It's interesting to look at the ways in which that case was covered by the media at the time, by the newspapers. The rhetoric, the language was about this, I suppose, the transgression of the benign woman, of womanliness, and the horror and fascination associated with that the auntie figure had inverted what was her fulfilled role in life into some kind of lethal weaponry.
Well, for those people who'd seen the stage play often put on the boards and seen the film of Arsenic and Old Lace, this would be no news at all. Both of the Brewer sisters there are women of advanced years and maintain a boarding house whereby they welcome into their establishment guys who are basically on the lam. They're kind of people displaced from society. And it's interesting to note that if Aunt Carrie, Mrs. Grills, falls into the stereotype, the representation established first by the Brewers, if that is the case, then it's also the case that she is involved with, as a lot of these people were involved with, attempting to polish off people who are not directly in their family, but as it were, virtual family members, sons-in-law, a crop up lots of times, as do lovers. But sons-in-law, as with Veronica Monty and Ruby Norton, are there centrally added. In other words, that it's like, it reminds me of the wartime situation around which the Korean War revolved, and the way that people would have looked at this. Civil war is a war between people who are not exactly familial, but are virtually familial. It's a feud of kind of vendetta. And the Korean War is at the background of a lot of this stuff. And it's not impossible that quite a lot of the people who use thallium used it to modulate a social situation, rather than to actually dispatch people. It was a way of controlling the fluxes and oscillations of situations in a very uncertain era.
Well, look, darling. Look, I'm frightfully sorry, but I've got an awful shock for you. Ted has killed a man, darlings.
Nonsense.
But there's a body in the window seat.
Yes, dear.
Well, what's he doing here? What happened to him?
He died. Yeah.
Look, Aunt Martha, men just don't get into window seats and die.
Oh, no, dear. The gentleman died because he drank some wine with poison in it.
Well, how did the poison get in the wine?
Well, we put it in wine because it's less noticeable. When it's in tea, it has a distinct odor.
You put it in the wine?
Yes, and I put Mr. Hoskins in the window seat because Reverend Harper was coming.
Oh. Oh, look at me, darling. You mean you knew what you'd done and you didn't want the Reverend Harper to see the body?
Well, not at tea. That wouldn't have been very nice.
Well, nuclear war. And the second coming of Jesus Christ. Armageddon and the coming war with Russia. What does all this have to do and to say with and to you and me? It says this, prepare to meet thy God.
There was a new war on, and it was the Korean War, and then after that, the Cold War set in with a whole series of new circumstances. The whole business that Felrat allowed people to pursue, which was producing symptoms on the bodies of other people, which is basically what I think a lot of them were into, not particularly killing them, but establishing a series of symptoms and then modulating them, deepening them, lessening them, or whatever it would be. And this, in retrospect, is exactly what states like the United States were doing to its citizens at exactly the same time in the early 50s, in the whole process of feeding people radioactive ingredients in things like cornflakes and food served in the ordinary domestic round, and which produced symptoms which scientists then modulated and observed.
If I stand starry-eyed, that's a danger in paradise.
For mortals
who stand beside.
10, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You enter the now. This is Dick and Easy. A message has gone out today. The first trial of an atomic weapon on the mainland of Australia successfully completed.
Somewhere in space, I hang suspended.
It's analogous. It's almost allegorical. But what one's looking at is an ethos, I think, what some historians would call a mentality, an overall series of assumptions and hierarchical arrangements within a society that produce effects from an overall grid of circumstances rather than the ordinary picture that we have of a rogue shark or a bad seed or whatever it would be. And the thallium enthusiasms of the late 40s and early 50s are a classic case in point, in this sense, because its uses were so varied. Everybody had access to it, and everybody kind of knew about it and what it could do. So it was adaptable. A seaman, for example, did not want to go back onto his ship in 1953. Well, he took some thallium. A lover has a tiff with his partner. He has some thallium. Somebody wants to give her husband a fright after he's come home and drunk and gone for her with the kitchen knife, so she goes around the corner. Other people seem to have had no motives at all. Some people used it for suicide, as well as alongside the specifically Thelrat related events, there were great outpouring of very inventive modes of social insult, like sending people tiger snakes in the mail and soda throwing, caustic soda throwing. A maniac in Melbourne who used to go around squirting people with sump oil out of a pump. The Como dog poisoner who was active in the middle of 1953, who dispatched some 35 dogs in that small area. There were zoo massacres at Toronto and other places up around near Newcastle. And generally speaking, it was an unleashing of a kind of an ethos that was part and parcel of, you know, like a McCarthyite situation where anybody who's vulnerable is a mug and deserves what they get. In a way, it was gratuitous, chaotic, and anarchic, and vicious in an era in which downright viciousness was not only, you know, due to the war, but due to the kind of ethos of the early 50s, the order of the day. Not for everybody, but for some.
Tell me why, though I try to forget, tell me why. Why I think of you yet, I know I'll never be free. What has happened to me?
Mrs. Veronica Mabel Monty, charged with administering the poison thallium to her son-in-law, rugby league star Bobby Lullum, with the intent to murder him. Mrs. Monty is alleged to have placed the poison in her son-in-law's cup of Milo on the evening of July 2nd, 1953.
I never dreamed of romance. Never gave it a chance.
The Monty case, too. Mrs. Monty case also, again, captured the public imagination. And it was, you know, the salacious aspect of it as well, I gather.
Yeah, well, Because Bobby Lullum was a kangaroo and very much in the limelight, and being a sports crazy country as we are, the people wanted to know every detail about Bobby, and then the other ingredients were the mother-in-law, who was having a sexual relationship of some description with him, and his very pretty bride. He was innocence personified. She was a daily communicant at the Catholic Church and all this sort of thing. And there's little old mother having off with Bobby while she's at Mass. I mean, I remember interviewing Mrs. Monty, and we started at the front door, and she eventually said, "Oh, you better come inside." But she didn't look very attractive. She was red-haired, but she sort of lounged around with, if you can visualise her, not actually, but in a sort of the nightgown early the next morning, puffing away at the cigarette and not looking you too directly in the eye and pretending that it was... this was just before it became established that she was having an affair, protesting her innocence.
The Mrs. Monty case, did either of you end up photographing Mrs. Monty?
I did. Okay. I photographed her in a hotel room in North Sydney.
She did, yeah.
And what kind of woman was she?
She seemed to be a very pleasant.
She was a very nice woman, wasn't she?
She was no oil painting, but that was the Bobby Lullum one. And I photographed Bobby Lullum in the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. sitting up in bed with hardly any hair, so I gave him a comb and I said, comb your hair, Bobby, and he said, right up. He's bald as a billy, as bald as a badger.
But he was in hospital.
Yeah, he recovered all right.
Mrs. Monty, Lullum and Thallium poison charge. Evidence of petting in the parlour. The Truth, December 13th, 1953. 2 days ago, Mrs. Veronica Monty was acquitted in Sydney's Central Court of having poisoned her son-in-law, Tigers footballer Bobby Lullum, with thallium. After the trial, Mrs. Monty was discovered in temporary residence at a North Sydney hotel. Asked about the incriminating discovery of thalrat in her home, Mrs. Monty explained,
I don't know what subconscious urge made me buy thallium. I was in Knock and Kirby's looking at plants when I found myself face to face with a bottle of the dreadful stuff. I was standing at the counter and bought it.
Tell me why, though I try to forget, tell me why I think of you yet. I know I'll never be free. What has happened to me?
It was interesting that in Mrs. Monty's defence she described that she was actually attempting to self-administer thallium. And she, her argument, her explanation for that attempt at self-administration was that she was feeling miserable and down in the dumps that day. It seems an extreme measure to take, but...
Well, not many people, even if they were having it off with their son-in-law, as she was, would think of polishing them off if there was some sort of alteration in the dynamics of the relationship, for example. But it says a lot about the ready availability of thallrat, that people might reach for a solution if they stubbed their toe, if there were minimal circumstances for using such maximal force. When Mrs. Monty declared that she in fact had intended the brew for herself, she kind of reversed the relationship, reversed the role that she had between her son-in-law and herself, so that she herself became the brunt and the object of her administration of thallrat. And she could do that up to a point because there were, thallrat existed, as it were, as a therapeutic means as much as anything else, alongside Beck's and Vincent's and liver pills and God only knows what, that people threw down their throats with great abandon, which did have poisonous effects on them largely, but which also stimulated their bodies maybe to produce feelings of well-being and stuff like that. So again, there's a boundary or a category break that's not being recognised.
When a whippoorwill's call and the evening is nigh, I hurry to my blue heaven.
Mrs. Caroline Grills, Mrs. Veronica Monty, Mrs. Yvonne Fletcher, Mrs. Beryl Haig, Mrs. Ruby Norton.
Blue heaven. You'll see a smiling face, a fireplace, a cozy room, a little nest that's nestled where the roses bloom, just my honey and me, and baby makes three. We're happy in my blue heaven.
Women could quite innocently go to the shops and request rat poison and nobody would, you know, think twice about it, because obviously, you know, if you're looking after the house and the household, that's a purchase that's totally consistent with that. But I do think in those stories, I mean, I must admit, you know, I was intrigued, as often these stories that assume almost the status of melodrama, you know, they have a tendency to have a horrid fascination about them.
Jean DeRue teaches cultural studies at the University of South Australia. She's interviewed women about their lives in Australia during the 1950s and how these memories fit into the ideologies around gender and the post-war suburban dream of 1950s Australia.
What really intrigued me, for instance, in the stories about Mrs. Grills, I think, is, you know, the notion of, you know, women's job above all things, surely, you know, in traditional ideologies, is about caring, and the giving of food is a quintessential part, you know, of that caring, that nourishing, both physical and emotional nourishing. And I just find that that's the most amazing irony. I mean, I'm not endorsing it, but that, you know, in what is the in a way, the quintessential act of femininity, the giving of food, that also becomes the means of doing away with people. So that, I mean, there's something very interesting going on there about, it's a kind of black humour, I suppose. I'm not just being macabre, I think there's something very interesting going on there about, almost about a kind of monstrous femininity, or on a domestic front, you know, on a very kind of banal level, you know, in giving someone a Swiss roll, or in the normal routines of domestic caring. You know, it's almost like saying there's something horrific lurking under the surface, and it's a way of reworking those, thinking about those routines, you know. I mean, how much are they about caring, and how much are they about coercion and constraint and restricted visions of femininity? I think that's the question for feminists.
Just my honey and me, and baby makes three. We're happy in my blue heaven. When the whippoorwills come and the evening is
not. I've had it. I tell you, I'm sick of you swinging them punches whenever I say boo. You're always slamming into me. It's not good enough, I tell you. All the other women have got nice new dresses. I haven't had a new dress since 1948. 4 years. You even go crook when I do my makeup to cover the bruises. You're lowering me. Bluey Fletcher, you're dragging me down to your level. It's not good enough. I've tried so hard. My aunt took me to dancing lessons. I had shoes with steel caps in them. I did real dancing. Real.
Do you think there's a way of reading the kinds of transgressions enacted by women in the 50s, transgressions like poisoning, as a way out of the kind of frustration that must have embodied some women's lives in the 50s?
I think it's certainly, you know, a possibility for speculation. I mean, poisoning is a fairly dramatic and overt form of resistance, I would have thought, and far be it from me to suggest that, you know, women in their misery over the sexual division of labour were kind of driven to drastic acts. But I mean, the notion of working out ways of making life habitable, I think, is a really interesting one. You know, if you are constrained and you see it impossible to actually alter the basic framework of that constraint, so society saying you must stay home and look after children and you'll just be kept, you won't be paid for that, and you're meant to find that glorious, and clearly your own experiences are much more mixed, you will find ways, I think, of making life habitable within those constraints. I mean, you could make a much more drastic gesture. Like, I asked the women I interviewed about whether they knew of any domestic violence in the community, any particular cases, and not asking them to cite these, of course, but just, you know, whether it was known in the community that that was going on, and what would women in those situations do. And these women said, yes, they were aware at the time that, you know, men predominantly were beating wives, but they kept saying, what would a woman do? First of all, because of the material constraints, it's extremely hard for a woman to support, you know, single-handedly young children, but also the kind of the fact that it was kept very private, you know, the censure of the community. And so that, I mean, dramatic resistances, of course, would be leaving or doing something to the perpetrator.
The Sydney Morning Herald, June 24, 1953. No more thallium in his tea. Today in the Sydney Coroner's Court, Mrs. Beryl Haig, domestic duties of Leichhardt, was committed to trial after having been charged with administering thallium via a cup of tea to her husband, Alan Vincent Haig. Mr. Haig, who survived the poisoning, is reported to have claimed that it was just an average cup of tea.
I got home around 6:30 after my usual round at the Gladstone Park Hotel. Beryl and I, well, we'd had a bit of a barney, and I just picked up one of the knives on the table. I only meant to threaten her with it, but she shot off out of the house, yelling at me. When Beryl came back, she seemed calmer, and she said to me, "I'll get you a cup of tea." As I said, it was just an average cup of tea, and I drank nearly all of it in one sip.
Mrs. Haig, who confessed to the poisoning, said that she'd popped a teaspoon in her husband's tea to
give him a headache.
Oh, life could be a dream if I could take you up in paradise up above. If you would tell me I'm the only one that you love. Life could be a dream, sweetheart. Hello, hello again.
I think it has to do with a grasping of modernism too, and the means, the instruments, what's available, the new stuff. That's part and parcel of this. This was a scientific approach to life, and for those who used it, not only Mrs. Monty and Yvonne Fletcher and Mrs. Grill, say, but it was extremely hard to take this stuff off the market. But this was, as I say, it wasn't a homicidal outbreak per se, but rather an experiment, a social and cultural experiment that people carried out alongside the wider cultural, social, national experiments that typified the post-war and Cold War era.
Shaboom, shaboom.
It's the fun of the world.
The Sydney Morning Herald, October 1953. The Minister for Health, Mr. O'Sullivan, said last night that the new Poisons Act would come into force tomorrow. He said that thallium had been included in the new legislation and that all retailers should become familiar with the laws.
The list was long, and I record it here in short order. Evidence, for instance, before the Lunacy Court in Glebe that a 72-year-old pensioner had swallowed thallium because, and I quote, he was in pain, as reported on June 15, 1953. A report on June 20th of CIB detectives arresting a 37-year-old sailor with quaffing thallium after a quarrel to attract his wife's sympathy and win back her affection. The sad case, whose circumstances we must only imagine, of a 23-year-old married woman being taken to St. Vincent's Hospital on a Saturday night, June the 18th, after taking thallium. The thallium poisoning of a 35-year-old Chinese seaman, Cheng Chang, who had recently been arrested as an illegal.
It isn't very hard to do. And you'll find happiness without an end. Whenever you pretend, remember anyone can dream, and nothing's bad as it may seem. The little things you haven't got could be a lot if you pretend.
You have been listening to another edition of Talking History. Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. For more information about Talking History, write Talking History, Department of History, University at Albany, 1400 Washington Avenue, Albany, New York, 12222.